James, chapter 1, verses 12 to 21. The third talk in a series on the book of James was presented by Rusty Rexius on May 8, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Third week in James, and we're not going to make it through the first chapter, but that's okay. I'm told that's just fine. I thought I would just not go through and review everything that we've talked about already, but rather I'm going to take just a minute and tell you what I think we know. Or, no, what I think I know that I'm telling you I think you should know too. Maybe that's the better way to put it. And then we'll go through 8 or 9 verses today. Here's what I think we know. We know that this author, James, is the brother of Jesus, or at least we think we know that. We know he's the head of the Jerusalem church. It dawned on me a week ago, the first messianic Jewish community. We know that he's writing to a group of struggling Jews all over the diaspora. He doesn't necessarily know them. In fact, he probably doesn't. He certainly heard about them. He knows of their trials because the trials that the Jews within Jerusalem, where he is, they're having the same issues and struggles as the Jews elsewhere. We know that God is in the business of crafting life circumstances, which always ask a question. Do your circumstances dictate what you believe, or will you believe in spite of your circumstances? The latter answer, over the course of our life, gives us certainty and confidence that one is truly a child of God. And as such, we know that one can be certain of one's own destiny, that is the telos, forgiveness, and life in the coming kingdom. But we also know that as life comes at us, it is not automatic, it is not easy, it is not simple to stand firm in what you believe and live our lives in the light of that belief. We know that at those times when the great questions of what we believe arrive, those who truly desire to know what is real and right and true can and should be confident that God will provide them wisdom, clarity, and conviction that what he says is true and is worthy of our allegiance. We know that one can ask this sort of thing, that is, for wisdom, and be confident of its receipt. And we know that James gave us an example of that, discussing the struggles of folks who have been financially stricken as a result of their belief by those who are financially well-to-do. I left here, got home, and it dawned on me last week that I left a verse off. I thought I had read verse 12, and I was puzzled, actually, by a couple of the questions, and I realized, well, I hadn't actually finished the section that I wanted. I don't know what happened. So pretend it's a week ago, and let me read verse 12 of chapter 1. Fortunate is the man who endures, that is, to hold one's ground, endures testing, because the one having been proved true will receive the crown of life, which he promised to the ones who love him. So what we had as basically a very quick review of those first 12 verses, we had James's thoughts on what part trials play, 1 through 8, and then we had an example of what a trial might look like and how one would respond to that, how a believer would respond to that. That's 9, 10, and 11. And then basically a sum of, see, this business about trials, if you can hang on, you can be proven that you're truly one who is telos, who will receive the crown of life. A couple of interesting things just in that verse 12 that I noted. James uses an interesting series of words. Perseverance or endurance leads to this thing called proven true or dokimos. And I'll talk about that in a minute, which leads to the crown of life. Those are all important things, clearly. Dokimos, you've heard that word before. I'm sure we've actually talked about it here. That's that process where they take metal and they heat it up and the fake stuff burns off and what's left is actually the real gold or silver, or maybe it's just gold in that case, such as the case with us in our trials, that testing, that heating up of our lives. And the stuff that is fake goes away, and if you're real, it's left. And that's the process that these trials are supposed to do. I did think a little bit further. Somebody suggested or noted or at least presented the possibility that the poor and the wealthy that James talks about, and again, I'm sorry, I'm not going to review all that, so if you were here, you know who I'm talking about, the poor and the wealthy that are James's example, and somebody asked maybe those two could both be believers. The more I thought about that, the less I think that's an option. I don't think it is believers. I think the poor that he's referring to are his audience. They're the believing Jews who are struggling. The wealthy are the adversary in that particular case. They're not the adversary because they're wealthy. They're not wrong because they're wealthy. They just happen to be unbelievers who are wealthy and are persecuting the poor. So I think he's juxtaposing these two groups of people, one a set of believers and one not. And the last thing I'll say, I haven't brought this up in verse 12. If you noticed at the very end of that, actually I don't remember what the New American Standard uses, but he says that the one having been proved true will receive the crown of life which he promised to the ones who love him. I think both the he and the him are referring to God. And I only bring that up because one of the things that has been historically problematic with James, in fact, Luther, as you probably all know, rejected it, well, most of his life. He decided it was worthy of our read. I don't know that he ever decided it was actually supposed to be part of the canon. But in any case, one of his problems with the book of James was that it didn't say Jesus enough. It didn't refer to the passion. It didn't refer to much of anything to do with Jesus. And because of that, Luther thought that it was misplaced as one of the books that one should read. James, and I don't think there was any doubt that James clearly understood the importance, the preeminence of Jesus. Nobody probably knew it better as his oldest brother. But that wasn't James's point here. James isn't talking about Jesus and the part that Jesus plays with respect to these people's circumstances. He's actually talking about God. This will come up actually in a minute when we get to this word logos in a couple of verses. So that was verse 12. Sorry for not remembering that last week. My mistake. We've got verses 13 through 21 today. I'm going to read those first, and then we'll power through them. Having been tempted, let no one say, I am tempted by God, for God is not liable to temptation to sin, and he himself tempts no one. But each one is tempted by one's own eager desire, having been dragged away and enticed. Then the eager desires, having taken, give birth to sin, and the sin, having been completed, bring forth death. Do not be led astray, my beloved brothers. Every gift that is good and every gift that is perfect is from above, coming from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or changing shadow. In accordance with his will, he has brought us into being by the logos of truth, for us to be a kind of first fruits of his creation. Know this, my beloved brothers. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. For a man's anger does not bring about the dikaiosune from God. 21, so rid oneself of all moral uncleanliness and abundance of depravity. In humility receive the implanted message which is able to save your souls. I think I'm going to take verses 13. Sorry, I'm going to make one comment. This is a section of scripture that I find two things to be true for me. One, I think I get it, but putting words to what I think I get has been hard, and I don't know why that is. So I hope there's some clarity there. This is also one of those places where this is not sermon material. This really is just Bible study material. So I've said it every week. I'll say it again. I have no intention of pontificating or sermonizing here. I really am hoping to engage you in a Bible study of sorts. So that's very much what this is going to feel like to me. I hope that's okay with you. Verses 13 and 14, let me read them again. I'm going to take them together. I think they're all related. Having been tempted, let no one say, I am tempted by God, for God is not liable to temptation to sin, and he himself tempts no one. And then verse 14, but each one is tempted by his own eager desires, having been dragged away and enticed. I think this is tricky because this whole business of being tempted by God, it's an argument that we've actually heard before. I think it's much the same as what we heard in and have seen in Romans. I wrote Romans 9 down here. It's related, I think. You will say to me then, why does one or he still find fault? For who has ever resisted his will? I think the question here that James is, well, I don't know if he's actually heard this from those around him, or if he's anticipating this as one's question. In any case, what he's thinking is, well, if this thing that you're telling us about, these trials, these challenges to our faith, it sure sounds like you're saying that God is tempting us. God is enticing us. God is welcoming us to an opportunity to sin. A couple of things to note. One, the word that we've been seeing for trial or temptation, that's a noun. Now we're looking at a verb. It's the same word group. Ultimately, you could argue it has the same meaning, but I think James has two different things in mind. That feels a little like a cop-out to me, that James just doesn't mean the same thing. He means something else. But I actually think that's what's going on here. James is thinking of something very different than the trial that he just described. Now he's actually talking about real temptation, luring in. We all know, we're all very familiar with what that is. So what James is saying is, don't say for a minute that I am tempted by God, for God is not liable to temptation to sin, and he himself tempts no one. I think in the case of the argument in Romans and this one, what James is saying is that these are both excuses. These are excuses for having come to the wrong answer. What God has delivered, this is the answer. What God has delivered up and asked me what I believe, that's led me to decide that what I want is more important than what God wants. That's on God. He's the one who put it there. I think that's ultimately what they're saying. Don't blame me. I didn't author this situation. God did. If you could put it in a more, well, I get accused of pithy examples, but one might say, one said, God, you put the candy on the table. I just took it. That's on you. But I think this misses the point. There is no doubt that God is the author of and creator of all circumstances that we find ourselves in. That's just true. But God is not luring us in. He's not trying to get us to do something we're not supposed to. That's how sometimes we take it. I think that's how sometimes it feels. But that's just simply not what's going on. That doesn't ring true of anything about God's character. But God has crafted our story. He's crafted our story to be sure that exactly the right time, in exactly the right circumstances, we have exactly what we need so that we know whether we believe or not. That's what he's done. He's not lured us. He's provided for us that chance to answer the question. We have this opportunity to find out who we are. What lures us is not God at all, but rather what lures us is exactly what needs correcting and what we find in front of us that we might have instead of what God wants. That's what's luring us. Ultimately, what's luring us is our desire to be God. At the end of the day, we want to be God, not God. And that's the lure. Let's just take an example, the example that James gave, see if this works. So what's the trial? The trial was that these folks are poor instead of wealthy precisely because of what they believe. It's not that they're poor. That's not the challenge. It's that they're poor because they believe. So that's the trial. So what's the test? What you believe, in particular about God, has significantly cramped your style. Your life is incredibly hard. That's the circumstance you find yourself in. God has authored that circumstance precisely to ask you this question. What matters more to you? What you say you believe, or that you have safety and comfort, and you get what you want now? What matters more? Notice God is not saying,
come to the dark side.
That's how we take it, but that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, and I was all prepared to do my Yoda voice, which I have a good one, but I'm not going to do it. But what he is saying is a Yoda quote, do or do not. There is no try. There appears, in the case of his readers or his prospective audience, there appears to be a way to minimize or eliminate their difficulty. But that would mean literally rejecting God and what they have come to believe, in this case about Jesus as Messiah, and all the promises that come with that, as over against or instead of, they take all of that or they get what they want. The lure is to get what they want. God was not saying, do it, which would be God tempting them. That's clearly not what he was saying. But what he was actually doing, well, he's asking them, are you going to take me seriously? And are you going to, in a very real way, stand firm on what you believe, stand firm on what I say is important, or are you going to try to be your own God? What God has said is those who persevere in their faith, no matter what, are going to get their reward. And that's the question they were faced with. Perseverance or reward, get what you want. I went to Cape Henry Bible School, which I'm not bragging about that. And while I was writing notes, I've oftentimes looked back at those notes. And what I wrote as notes were little ditty after little ditty after little ditty. In other words, it wasn't like exegesis of the Bible, but it was these little sayings that the teachers had come up with. And I found myself now, that's kind of what I end up doing at the end of when I have studied something, I write a little ditty. So I've got all these little ditties. It just dawned on me yesterday as I was reviewing. And one of my little ditties was, the places you find yourself in life are merely questions about how important what you believe is. That's what life is. That's my first little ditty. Verse 14, continuing the thought, but each one is tempted by his own eager desire, having been dragged away and enticed. We've already talked about this. But, so, it's not God who is tempting you, but instead, what's tempting you is your own eager desires. Desires in and of themselves are not the problem. That's not a negative word. That's not a disparaging word. There are two verses I found. One of them was Jesus who said in Luke, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. There was another example which was negative. Therefore, God gave them over to their desires of their hearts to impurity. But the desire is just that. It's a desire. That's not the problem. Instead, it is, what's the desire for? A desire is not problematic. What the desire for is the problem. And in the context of what I'm assuming James is writing into, I think that desire ultimately is to make my life what I want, not what, instead what God wants. That, I think, is the eager desire, to be God. Maybe even more specifically, as God, I write my own story. God doesn't write my story, I write my story. God has orchestrated events such that belief in what we say or what he says, that has cost something. It has cost a great deal, extraordinary discomfort. And the eager desire in this particular case is to not be uncomfortable. That's the challenge, that's the question, that's the test, that's the desire. And what is the one way in this particular case, and you can take it into your own situations very easily, what is the one way that such eager desire or that great discomfort, could be gone away? Well, how do you rid yourself of it? Reject what God has said. The problem leaves. You simply reject what God has said. Again, in the case of James's audience, this could not have been more simple. Stop claiming that Jesus is Messiah and all that goes along with that, and we will stop persecuting you. It's a clear choice. The eager desire is to stop being persecuted, to be comfortable, to have a lifestyle back that they once had, and if they do that, everything gets better. Or they maintain, they continue, they persevere in their belief. This is what I think James means by being dragged away and enticed. They were lured, not by God, but by their own desire for comfort. They were mentally dragged away, not physically, I doubt, mentally dragged away from what one knows is true, and is because the circumstances of that truth are painful. That's what's dragging them away. That's what's luring them. One is dragged away for other options. And what is the enticement? Comfort, simplicity, and control, and not having to endure the cost of what you believe. And, in the bigger picture, what you're being dragged away and enticed for is to not have to live as a mere creature. Play God. Be God. Don't tell me, I'll tell God, which I think is ultimately behind all of our sin. So this is what James is talking about with respect to what God's role is in the first part of what we looked at, and now what God's role isn't in the places where we insert ourselves, play the role of God, which is ultimately our problem and the sin, which is what he's going to talk about right now. Verse 15, then the eager desires having taken give birth to sin, and the sin having been completed brings forth death. So again, in the case of James's audience, what he would be speaking into is this desire not to suffer. The suffering is because one has claimed Jesus to be the Messiah. To achieve the desire, if one only reject that faith and that truth, which is essentially to reject God, everything gets better. So in the end, specifically with respect to James's audience, but in any case, All sin comes down to the rejection of God and his role as creator. I think that's ultimately what the story is here. And when one has rejected God and what he has said is true, the opposite of perseverance and belief happens. And the inevitable result, what is always the end of that choice? Death. Ultimate death. And here's a ditty. The eager desire to be our own author, which leads us to reject what God has scripted and write our own plan, is our ultimate demise. That's what takes us down. And we all know it. You all know it. You've all felt it. Maybe you're better than I am. I have certainly felt that desire to simply not go down the road that God has chosen for me, but instead go down the road that I have scripted and I have written, which is exactly what I think James's audience is wondering whether or not they should do. The rejection of God as author, as a conclusion, as a lifelong conclusion, always leads to death. Verse 16, do not be led astray, my beloved brothers. In other words, don't let yourself be convinced otherwise. That is either by a whisper in your ear, it can be better. You can make it better for yourself. It doesn't have to be this way. Or what you actually see in others and what you are specifically being told by your opponents. What we don't know here in the case of James is whether or not somebody was actually telling them, step aside from this silly belief in Jesus as Messiah and do what you know you ought to do, reject him, and everything will be better. I don't know if somebody was telling them that or not, but they clearly knew that was the case. If they would just reject their belief, life would get better. So whether it was a whisper in their ear or whether it was actually somebody telling that, I don't know. But what James is saying is, don't be led astray. Don't do it. Don't be tempted to walk away. That whisper, I've never had an audible voice in my ear, but countless times I have heard, it's not worth this. It's not worth it. There are so many other things that you could commit yourself to, commit your time to, commit your energy to, so many other things that you could be and do and achieve instead. This isn't worth it. Very real to me not to be led astray. But instead, he says, verse 17, every gift that is good and every gift that is perfect is from above, coming from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or changing shadow. The gift, I think, that he talks about, the gift is the opportunity to see, even if by difficult circumstances. That's a gift. I don't know that we ever think of it that way. But the gift that comes from God is that chance for us to see, to know, to find conviction and confidence. That's the gift. And what is truly good, and this is tricky, so stick with me. What is truly good and what actually leads to what matters most is whatever it is that God has provided. What is truly good and what actually leads to what matters most is whatever it is that God has provided. And that is to say this, in spite of what looks to be good and perfect, that might be rephrased as something like health and wealth and prosperity, in any form of that that is attractive to you, what looks to be good and perfect and what is actually good is not those things, but it is precisely and only what God has drawn up. So there's a whole set of things that appear to be good that we think of as good, but what is actually good is whatever it is that God has authored. It might be health or wealth or prosperity, but that's not what's good. It's only good because God drew it up. It might be suffering and poverty and sickness and whatever else we might be faced with. If God has drawn it up, it is good, and that's what makes it good. It is not that there are good things and that there are bad things that people may want, although that's true, but it is rather that the only truly good thing and the only things that lead to what we all need to finish the race is exactly what God is serving, whatever that is. Whatever he's serving up, that is precisely what we need, and that is what's good. Every gift that is good and every gift that is perfect is from above. And it's from whom, he says? It's from the Father of light. I thought about doing a little more extent. There's lots of talk about light. There's more discussion about the Father of light. I opted to just go with this. The Father of light is the one and the only one who enlightens. That's what the Father of light is. He is the progenitor of light. That is, the creator of precisely what we need to see, i.e. light, to see what is true and is meaningful and is real. It is God that enlightens. It is God that opens our eyes. He is the one, he is the only one who gives us that opportunity to see what matters, what makes a difference, what we really should want. There is simply no other source, none. There is no other way to find out what matters, what's true and what's real, other than what's from God. And, James says, what God brings, this is, there is no variation, what God brings is utterly consistent. There is no other thing that God ever brings but what is good and what is enlightening. He brings nothing else. Now, again, this, maybe you've thought about this your whole life, but somehow in my head I've thought about that God is like busy bringing good things, and then meaning the things that matter to do what he intends to do, and then he's just doing normal things or something. Like somehow there's categories of things that God does, things that are meaningful and then something else. But the fact of the matter is God is only busy bringing up good things. That's what he does. Everything that he does is good. Everything that he does is to enlighten. Everything that he does is to grow up us, not him. 100%. No exceptions. God is only doing what is good. The only thing that God gives ever is exactly what whomever he loves needs. And as one that needs it, we should want it. And the last thing he says, that other than no variation, there is no changing shadow. That is, the shadow cast from who he is, and I think it is what we see from him, is always the perfect image of him. His activity precisely outlines exactly who he is. That shadow never changes. This is my point. It never is anything other than good. And precisely what he has said is important, matters, and is meaningful. So every gift that is good, it's not, notice it's not that some of the gifts we get are good from God. But every gift that is good, every opportunity that we have to see is good, and every gift that is perfect is from God. It's from God the Father of light, the one who enlightens, the one who allows us to see. And in that one, there's never any differentiation, never changing, never variation, always consistent, and it's never has a changing shadow. It's always the image and reflection of who God is. I find that incredibly powerful. I'd never quite looked at it that way before. Very helpful for me to think about circumstances of life and how those things find their way into my life and how I am seeing them. We'll talk about this at the end, but I'll let you ponder it for a minute. Don't you oftentimes in your circumstances of life, and I'm going to actually talk about this specifically in a minute, but you categorize the things that happen in your life. Oh, that must be something that came from God to test me. But this one over here is just sort of the average everyday part of life. So we treat them differently. But the reality is it's all from God. It's all part of our test. It's all part of how we're asking ourselves the question, am I or am I not one who believes? Not just the hard stuff, the challenging stuff, the more meaningful, meaty stuff. It's not just that stuff that he's talking about that's from God, but it's all of it. And it's all part of a test for us. Verse 18, the why the good gifts are from God. In accordance with his will, he has brought us into being by the logos of truth, for us to be the kind intention of his first fruits. This is what I think James is telling his audience. This is why God is doing this. This is what God is up to. This is ultimately what you have to look forward to. This is why you should endure. This is why you should persevere. This is why you should listen to me and hang with it. This is why you shouldn't be led astray. This is why you should know that God is good and he is the giver of all that is good. And there's never any difference in what God gives. Because, he says, in accordance with his will, he has brought us into being by the logos of truth for us to be the kind of first fruits of his creation. We'll start with the first few words there. With respect to the Father of light, the one who created and is good, with respect to that one, he has brought us into being. Just let's stop for a minute and remember, because this is what I did. He's brought us into being, like out of nothing. This is not news to you. I mean, this is the sort of thing around here that we hear a lot and talk about a lot. But he has brought us into being. He has created us out of nothing. He has designed for us out of nothingness what his kind intentions are. He has crafted, written, whatever analogy you want to do, he has written us into the story at his own and by his own kind intention. The author of all that is wrote me into the story. He has brought me into being and you. That's amazing. We poop, whatever. No, but I'm here because he authored me. He brought me into being. He's the author of my existence. I mean, I know that's what Paul says in Acts, and I love that verse, but it is in whom, Paul says, in him that we move and we breathe and we have our very existence. If not for him, I wouldn't. That gives me chills. In accordance with his will, he has brought us into being by the logos of truth. There's a lot we could say about that. A handful of roads to go down, what that might mean. I didn't go and count again. There are either 53 or 57 different uses of the word logos. When I say different uses, I mean different translations, different ways to translate that word. I counted them, 53 or 57. Two of them, John and 1 John, I think, are clearly referring to Jesus. This one's not, I don't believe. I only bring that up because the temptation is, I think, for some, is to look at this and automatically think that he has brought us to existence by the logos of his truth. What he's saying is that Jesus brought us into existence, which may or may not be the case. That's not my point. My point is that the logos of truth is something different here, very different than Jesus in terms of the logos. So what is it? I'm going to borrow at least one or two words that Jack has used before because I like them and I think they're right. I suspect that the logos here must mean something along the lines of plan or script. And in this particular case, he has brought us into existence by the script of what is true, the script or the plan that is actually real, the meaningful script, the only script that actually matters. And in this particular case, it is the ultimate and the real creative purposes of God. He scripted me into being because that's his plan, that's his intention, that's what he decided to do. It is exactly what he has authored. He has authored me by the script of his real, meaningful, purposeful intentions. And you. If this is connected to the previous thought, that is that God, who is the author of light, which I think it is, then James is making a very grand statement to explain exactly what God is up to in the world. And what is God up to in the world? He says it at the end of that verse. In accordance with his will, he has brought us into being by the script of his truth. Why? For us to be a kind of first fruits of his creation. He has authored us as believers to be the very harvest of his creation. His intention at the exact time when we are ripe, which if I can back up, I think the exact time that we are ripe is when we have persevered to the end that we are complete, telos. That's when we're ripe. He is to bring us into his storehouse. Again, maybe I'm just in one of those moods, but so God sat down, or however he did it, with his scripting pen, and he wrote a story specifically that included me that would go through a whole set of circumstances, assuming that this is how it turns out, that he authored, that will ultimately allow me to know whether I am or I am not one of his, whether I will persevere to the end or not. And if and when I do, he will pick me out of the sea of humanity to spend eternity in his kingdom. And he wrote that story long ago for me. Amazing. Absolutely remarkable. That is the story that he has been busy writing and I'm a part of it. This isn't even in my notes, but this was one of these powerful moments. We were at this conference. It was a youth conference. I used to go to those often. And there was this guy, Louis Giglio was his name. Some of you may have heard him. And he was actually talking about this. And I wish we had the video. It's pretty fun. But so he's standing on this huge stage, and he's doing all these hand motions. And what he's just described is all of creation, the entirety of creation from start to end, and how God has authored it in advance. So this is what this man is saying. And he's talking about watching that as though it were a movie. And so he's standing there and he's watching the movie and there's Adam and Eve and look at there's Noah and Abraham and oh my goodness, there's Moses and there's Jesus and oh, there's me! There's me! And he went on and on and on about how he was in the script just like all those other people. And that just, man, that's true. I'm in there too. which is exactly what he's saying here. And he is going to harvest me at exactly the right time. I find that remarkable. Why is James saying this? It's good things for anybody to say, but why is James saying this? I think he's saying this to remind his readers of the meta story, instruct and encourage them not to lose sight of where their circumstances line up in the grand scheme and plan of God. He wants them to know they're in the story. He wants them to know that the circumstances are worth it. He wants them to know that God has placed them in precisely those circumstances because that's exactly what they need. That's why he's telling them all of this, so that they don't lose sight of what it is that God is up to. Yeah, it sucks that they don't have any money and they're being pummeled by the wealthy people. That's not fun and it's not a good place to be, but don't lose sight of why. Don't lose sight of the bigger story. There is zero, zero that is random. There is no such thing as chaos with God. And in spite of the pain and the discomfort, it is good. It is good what you are enduring and you are involved with because God has authored it. Remember, don't be led astray. This could not be more relevant to us. Verse 19, know this, my beloved brothers and sisters. Let everyone be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. This has to be James speaking with respect to how you are thinking about the circumstances that you find yourself in and the disagreement that you are having within yourself about the sensibilities and the authenticity and the actual value of what you believe. With respect to how you're processing all that, do three things. Be quick to listen, seek and search and grope for the words that are true. Be quick to listen. Ultimately, that's listening to God. Secondly, be slow to speak. That is to say, slow to speak what very naturally comes out, challenging God and what he is up to in my life. Be slow to speak. And then lastly, be slow to anger. I think this is the anger towards God and what he has authored. Not anger towards the rich guy across the street because he has and you don't. Not even angry because he took what was yours and won't give it back. I think this is angry at God for the script that he has written and what he has authored in your life. Be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Well, this is not a particularly complicated or deep concept. It seems to me this is some of the most profound, practical, and useful advice anybody could ever give. About anything, all the time, but especially with respect to these sorts of things. Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. Verse 20, for a man's anger does not bring about the dikaiosune from God. This is why I think the anger is towards God and not your fellow man or whatever the circumstances you find yourself in. I have to assume the anger is the anger towards God because the alternatives don't really make sense. How would it be that an anger to another person doesn't bring about the dikaiosune? Well, dikaiosune, I know you've heard this 150 million times. Just quickly say the pardon from God. I don't even know what the New American Standard, must probably righteousness, I suppose. But so, sorry, I should have mentioned that. So you're not going to get God's pardon. Well, I mean, ultimately, I suppose if you're always angry, it says something about, with respect to your fellow brothers. There is something about being angry that's not right, and we shouldn't do that. But I don't think that's what he's talking about here. I think he's talking about being angry at God for having been the creative hand behind their circumstances. He's just said, be very, very quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger, because the anger towards God doesn't ultimately get you pardon, the pardon that you're reaching out to get from God. Why not? Because you can't be at odds with God and expect him ultimately and expect his forgiveness. Those are mutually exclusive. This is not just being frustrated with God and the circumstances he has put you in. We've all been there. Maybe we've been there a lot. Maybe we're there right now. We'll probably be there tomorrow. It's not being frustrated. It's not being challenged by the fact that he's God and you're not. That's natural. He's put you there, and that's hard. And to be frustrated with that is not what's at issue here. It's ultimately concluding that God has no right to do that. God has no business authoring those circumstances in my life. That's not his job. That should be my job. That's what being angry is, and that's what doesn't receive his pardon. My Diddy, this is finding yourself at odds with God and in the end rejecting what he has done. This person will not receive God's pardon. And then the last verse. So rid yourself of all moral uncleanliness and abundance of depravity. In humility, receive the implanted message which is able to save your souls. I think this is the moral uncleanliness and abundance of depravity as a result of the anger towards God. This would fit the pattern of the argument, but does it make sense? I think the language actually seems a little funny here, and it isn't these words for moral uncleanliness and abundance of depravity. Those are actually fairly unique to this particular passage, but it does seem to line up with what James is saying. The one who becomes angry with God and the lot that he has chosen, in this case specifically for the ones who have limited means, the poor ones, they turn themselves over to immorality and depravity in a search for a better life. So as over against the pursuit of righteousness and goodness, what is true in light of what they believe, they chase something out, something entirely different, because they want a different circumstance. So they commit themselves to immorality. They commit themselves to depravity to get what they want. I assume James has heard of this going on. It's probably been happening in Jerusalem. Maybe something along the lines of a Roman lifestyle. I don't know. But I think ultimately, and I'm not going to yell it, I did this once in my life, and many have never recovered from it. But what James is saying is repent. Repent. Rids oneself of all moral uncleanness and depravity. And in humility, receive the implanted message which is able to save your souls. In humility towards God, God who has the prerogative as creator to do as he pleases, and an authentic admission that God's mind exceeds my own. That God's mind exceeds my own. That's the humility to receive, accept, acknowledge, embrace, own, grab hold of, wrap your arms around. The implanted message, that's the same message I think we heard before, the one that God has scripted, the one that matters, the only one that actually matters, the one that God has written for you, specifically for you, that leads you to what is true and what is real and what is essential. It is that with humility that we would receive that implanted message, because the only way to save your soul is to do so. To embrace the message that God has authored on your behalf, accept it, and live it out is the only way to save your soul. It's the only way to get in, is to embrace the message that God has crafted. And why is it so important to receive, embrace, and acknowledge and own the story that God has written for one's life? Because that's the only way you can save your soul. I have two ending thoughts, and then we'll have 10 minutes or so, which I will read. This notion of this, that the reception of God's implanted message being the only way to save your soul is an interesting and fascinating and even profound thing. What I normally think of as what will save my soul is the story of Jesus. That is to say that what saves my soul is believing that Jesus has come and has lived the life that he lived in order that his sacrifice on the cross would satisfy the requirement of God's Messiah, or to be God's Messiah. As such, Jesus has so pleased God that when he advocates for someone's release, my release, God will oblige. That's exactly true. All that's true. But for one to get there, for one to really and authentically get to a place where any of that carries any ultimate legitimacy, that is to say, one has truly given one's heart over to that reality of who Jesus is and what that's all about, God must write that script. The truth of Jesus is true, but for that to set in, God has to write that script for me. I don't get to write that one. I can't write that one. I'd never write that one. God writes that script for me. And not only that, but it is the very process that God has authored, which includes coming to grips with what it means for Jesus to be the Messiah, that determines my destiny. It is the process that God takes me through that determines my destiny. And in order for me to get to that first thing I read, God has to bring me there. He is the author of my destiny. This is why what we do with our lives is so incredibly important. It is truly and ultimately to reveal who we are. It is to reveal what God has scripted. So we have a job to do. We have a job to do, and that is to figure out what we believe. And whether what we believe, what we say is true, really is, which is exactly what James is going to talk about next. But I won't go there because I'm out of time. My last little thought, and I mentioned this before, so I'll keep it short. It seems to me that we categorize, so this is a little bit aside from the text, but this is back to these categories of life circumstances. It seems like we put life into three categories. At least I do. There's the crisis category. the one that I oftentimes think about as the real test of who I am, that moment in time, that watershed event, and I've heard some of you talk about some of your watershed events. I've had one or two of my own. Susie and I both have. Those are those crisis moments, and I think those are the things that we're normally, I'm thinking about normally in the context of something like we're looking at in James, those sort of big deals, where we come away from the big deal and we go, got through that one, and I'm just going to hang on until the next one. And in the meantime, you know, life just sort of goes on. And then there's the opposite end of that, the mundane things, the tying of our shoes and the deciding what's for dinner and what color am I going to make my hair today if you're one of those folks. And, you know, just the silly stuff in life, the stuff that just simply doesn't matter. And in some respects, I don't think it does matter. God authored that too. He didn't author it any less than he did the crisis. But it is the mundane. It doesn't seem to be the real testing points in life. But then there's this middle category. And what dawned on me as I was studying and thinking about this and reflecting on my own life, the middle is where we spend most of our life, isn't it? The mundane, there's a lot of it there too, but the middle is just what we're doing all day. The decisions that we're making, the paths that we're taking ourselves and our neighbors and our moms and, all the stuff that we're doing, that middle area. But what I have found, especially recently in my life, it is in the middle area where I find more about who I am than I ever do in the crisis areas, because there's so many of them. There's so many middle spots that ask me daily, who are you? I'll give you two examples. The one is there's a plethora of them, but in the business world that I live in so many times, constantly I am faced with this question, what do you believe? What do you really believe? For example, maybe there's a deal that we're trying to cut, and by my slight exaggeration of some facts, the deal is better for me. It's just a slight exaggeration. Nobody's going to get hurt. It's just a little tweak of the truth, and life is way better for me. And I sit there and I contemplate whether or not I ought or ought not exaggerate whatever it is I'm thinking about. I think that's a middle area, and I think that oftentimes says way more about me than what I do with the grand crisis of life. And those happen all the time, and I struggle with them every day, oftentimes not very successfully. The second area, for me, I happen to be a habitual basketball player. My family has heard countless stories of my travails on the court. And if you've heard anybody who's an athlete talk, you'll hear them say, and I'm not saying I'm an athlete, I happen to do an athletic event, but they'll say, and it's true, your more character is revealed on a court than any place in the universe. I find for me, though, the question about who I am is more often asked when I'm playing basketball than it maybe even is in my business world. There are so many of them, and in order to tell you the stories, I would have to embarrass some people that you actually know maybe, but forever and ever and ever, I am asked this question as a basketball player, who are you? And while it's just basketball, and what other players like to say is just on the court, that stays between the lines. That's just inside the line. That's not actually real life. No, it is real life. It does say something about who you are. It's very revealing about who you are and what you stand for when you cheat to win. Just ask my family. I mean, I'm getting angry thinking about it. I hate cheaters. But the sad thing is, sometimes I'll cheat to win. And I'd never admit it, but I know I do, because I'm no good. I'm a no good, you know what. But more times than not, it is much more subtle things. I'm not playing well, and I'm mad at God because I'm not playing well. I mean, it just seems so ridiculous, but it's true. It's the middle places where I'm wondering and being asked, who are you, and what are you up to in this world? I think more times often than not, that's the world that James is speaking to. Those are the tests about who I actually am and what I believe. The crisis moments, for sure. I mean, those are those, like, everybody knows. Those are real. You're really confronted with some things in those crisis moments. But those are few and far between. This other stuff happens all the time. And it's sad what most of the time comes out. Now, granted, and hopefully, and I believe over time, that stuff works itself out where, with wisdom and asking for wisdom, which is what James has said you're supposed to do, you sort that stuff out. But it is those places that I'm asking for wisdom all the time, constantly, because I find I have very little. that's just business. That's just on the court. No, that's just who you are, and it's not pretty. Questions, comments, corrections, or rebukes? And I didn't forget a verse, I don't think.
Okay, I have to apologize. Somehow my brain glitched. I was interested in what you were going to say about the implanted message, and somehow I missed what it is you said about it. Could I ask you to repeat that again?
I do. I think that's the message is what God has written to be true.
Is it the script again? Is that the...
Well, I think it's what the script tells us about what's true. And I think the implanted message is just God's enlightening us to what that actually means, why that even matters, why I should even care about that. Eyes to see and ears to hear. I think that's okay. How I would...
Good, thanks.
I wish it were a chip, a little chip that I wouldn't have to think about it.
I have an exegetical question. It concerns a word that you translated, kind intention. It's kind of a technical thing, but I struggle translating that word because kind intention doesn't quite, at least my sense of it, doesn't quite actually get to the meaning. I want to say it's more related to goodwill, but not in the sense we use it, but the fact God's willing good. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on that word.
Remind me where that is.
It was in the, more closer to the beginning, around verse 13 or 14 or 12. I'm going by memory. I don't
think I used kind intention.
You didn't?
I don't think I did. I think I did it. Oh, there. No?
Okay, maybe I heard it wrong.
I do think it's in the New American Standard. I mean, I remember that.
Logan, you'll have to read it for me.
I'm sorry, I don't remember where that is, though.
Yeah, I don't. I don't want to waste our time, so... I'll get
okay.
back to you on
okay.
that.
Okay, yeah, no, I'd be happy to talk about that. That's the part of this, by the way. I love that work, the actual parsing that stuff, and I find what I end up with is not very much explanation of any of that, how I got there. So if that's interesting, I'm happy to talk about that at some point.
I think you touched on this, but so many of the quote-unquote verses begin with the word but each one is tempted. But the brother of him humble circumstances, but he must ask in faith, but everyone must be quick to hear. In English, that has a not this, but that.
Yeah.
And it messes with us a little bit.
I can't talk about that because that's the conjunction de. And oftentimes, I don't know, probably most times it's translated but. I think it's just as easily translated and. Sometimes maybe indeed, although that's more chi than de. There's tons of ways to take that, and I don't think that it is contrasting, especially in this particular case. It's way more linear. This is true, so this is true, so this is true, so this is true.
And so
I think, in fact, oftentimes you can leave it out. You don't even have to translate it, but...
It's sort of interpolated here in 19. It says, this you know, my beloved brethren, in the New American, and this is in italics, so it's not there. So which is it you know, that we are a kind of first fruits among his creatures, or are we already know that we should be quick to hear?
I took it as an imperative, know this thing, parenthetically my brothers, and then what they're to know are these three things. Be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. That's how I took it.
And so he's, for the anger of man does not achieve, you mean bring into being or make happen the righteousness of God, the pardon of God.
Right.
That seems really obvious. Being mad at God doesn't make you right, right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, put yourself in their position, yeah. Right? They're in a circumstance where they're suffering. And the question is, do you want out or do you want God's pardon?
And he's not talking about the guy who takes up arms against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune and fights back?
I don't think he is.
Okay.
He could be, but I don't think so.
So you think it's definitely, this is not someone trying to prove to God through his anger that he's serious about this stuff and uh-uh. He's not going to take it?
I don't.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like anything with this, this is what I think. But and I'm certainly willing to be wrong about that, for sure. But that wouldn't make sense to me. Okay, thank you.